Mouth. I will gently close my teeth upon it, but I will not bite down. If there is no treachery afoot, I will open my mouth when I have escaped the ribbon, or when you have freed me, and his hand will be unharmed. There, I swear, if I have a hand in my mouth, you can tie me with your ribbon. So, whose hand will it be? The gods looked at each other. Balder looked at Thor. Heimdall looked at Odin. Hymir looked at Frey. But none of them made a move. Then Tyr, Odin's son, sighed, and stepped forward and raised his right hand. "I will put my hand in your mouth, Fenrir," said Tyr. Fenrir lay on his side, and Tyr put his right hand into Fenrir's mouth, just as he had done when Fenrir was a puppy and they had played together. Fenrir closed his teeth gently until they held Tyr's hand at the wrist without breaking the skin, and he closed his eyes. The gods bound him with Gleipnir. A shimmering snail's trail wrapped the enormous wolf, tying his legs, rendering him immobile. "There," said Odin. "Now, Fenris Wolf, break your bonds. Show us all how powerful you are." The wolf stretched and struggled. It pushed and strained every nerve and muscle to snap the ribbon that bound it. But with every struggle, the task seemed harder, and with every strain, the glimmering ribbon became stronger. At first, the gods snickered. Then the gods chuckled. Finally, when they were certain that the beast had been immobilized and that they were in no danger, the gods laughed. Only Tyr was silent. He did not laugh. He could feel the sharpness of Fenris Wolf's teeth against his wrist, the wetness and warmth of Fenris Wolf's tongue against his palm and his fingers. Fenrir stopped struggling. He lay there, unmoving. If the gods were going to free him, they would do it now. But the gods only laughed the harder. Thor's booming guffaws, each louder than a thunderclap, mingled with Odin's dry laughter, with Balder's bell-like laughter. Fenrir looked at Tyr. Tyr looked at him bravely. Then Tyr closed his eyes and nodded. "Do it," he whispered. Fenrir bit down on Tyr's wrist. Tyr made no sound. He simply wrapped his left hand around the stump of his right and squeezed it as hard as he could to slow the spurt of blood to an ooze. Fenrir watched the gods take one end of Gleipnir and thread it through a stone as big as a mountain and fasten it under the ground. Then he watched as they took another rock and used it to hammer the stone deeper into the ground than the deepest ocean. "Treacherous Odin," called the wolf. "If you had not lied to me, I would have been a friend to the gods. But your fear has betrayed you. I will kill you, father of the gods. I will wait until the end of all things, and I will eat the sun, and I will eat the moon. But I will take the most pleasure in killing you." The gods were careful not to get within reach of Fenrir's jaws, but as they were driving the rock deeper, Fenrir twisted and snapped at them. The god nearest him, with presence of mind, thrust his sword into the roof of Fenris Wolf's mouth. The hilt of the sword jammed in the wolf's lower jaw, wedging the jaw open and preventing it from ever closing. The wolf growled inarticulately, and saliva poured from its mouth, forming a river. If you did not know it was a wolf, you might have thought it a small mountain, with a river flowing from a cave mouth. The gods left that place where the river of saliva flowed down into the dark lake, and they did not speak. But once they were far enough away, they laughed some more, and clapped each other on the back, and smiled the huge smiles of those who believe they have done something very clever indeed. Tyr did not smile, and he did not laugh. He bound the stump of his wrist tightly with a cloth, and he walked beside the gods back to Asgard, and he kept his own counsel. These, then, were the children of Loki. Freya's unusual wedding. Thor, god of thunder, mightiest of all the Aesir, the strongest, the bravest, the most valiant in battle, was not entirely awake yet, but he had the feeling that something was wrong. He reached out a hand for his hammer, which he always kept within reach while he slept. He fumbled around with his eyes closed. He groped about, reaching for the comfortable and familiar shaft of his hammer. No hammer. Thor opened his eyes. He sat up. He stood up. He walked around the room. There was no hammer anywhere. His hammer was gone. Thor's hammer was called Mjolnir. It had been made for Thor by the dwarfs Brok and Eitri. It was one of the treasures of the gods. If Thor hit anything with it, that thing would be destroyed. If he threw the hammer at something, the hammer would never miss its target and would always fly back through the air and return to his hand. He could shrink the hammer down and hide it inside his shirt, and he could make it grow again. It was a perfect hammer in all things except one. It was slightly too short in the handle, which meant that Thor had to swing it one-handed. The hammer kept the gods of Asgard safe from all the dangers that menaced them and the world. Frost giants and ogres, trolls and monsters of every kind, all were frightened of Thor's hammer. Thor loved his hammer, and his hammer simply was not there. There were things Thor did when something went wrong. The first thing he did was ask himself if what had happened was Loki's fault. Thor pondered. He did not believe that even Loki would have dared to steal his hammer. So he did the next thing he did when something went wrong, and he went to ask Loki for advice. Loki was crafty. Loki would tell him what to do.
"Don't tell anyone," said Thor to Loki, "that the hammer of the gods has been stolen."
"That," said Loki, making a face, "is not good news. Let me see what I can find out." Loki went to Freya's hall. Freya was the most beautiful of all the gods. Her golden hair tumbled about her shoulders, and it glinted in the morning light. Freya's two cats prowled the room, eager to pull her chariot. Around her neck, as golden and shining as her hair, glittered the necklace of the Breesings, made for Freya by dwarfs far underground.
"I'd like to borrow your feathered cloak," said Loki, "the one that lets you fly."
"Absolutely not," said Freya. "That cloak is the most valuable thing I possess. It's more valuable than gold. I'm not having you wearing it and going around and making mischief."
"Thor's hammer has been stolen," said Loki. "I need to find it."
"I'll get you the cloak," said Freya. Loki put on the feathered cloak and he took to the air in falcon shape. He flew beyond Asgard. He flew deep into the land of the giants, looking for something unusual. Beneath him, Loki saw a huge grave mound, and sitting on it, plaiting a dog collar, was the hugest, ugliest ogre of a giant he had ever seen. When the ogre saw Loki in falcon shape, he grinned a sharp-toothed grin and waved.
"What's up with the Aesir, Loki? What's the news from the elves? And why have you come alone into the land of the giants?"
Loki landed beside the ogre.
"There's nothing but bad news from Asgard and nothing but bad news from the elves."
"Really?" said the ogre, and he chuckled to himself as if he were extremely pleased with something he had done and thought himself remarkably clever.
Loki recognized that sort of chuckle. Sometimes he did it himself.
"Thor's hammer is missing," said Loki. "Would you know anything about that?"
The ogre scratched his armpit, and he chuckled once more.
"I might," he admitted.
Then he said,
"How's Freya? Is she as beautiful as they say?"
If you like that sort of thing, said Loki.
Oh, I do, said the ogre. I do.
There was another uncomfortable silence. The ogre put the dog collar down on a pile of dog collars and began to plait another.
I have Thor's hammer, the ogre told Loki. I've hidden it so deep beneath the earth that nobody could ever find it, not even Odin. I am the only one who could bring it up again, and I will return it to Thor if you bring me what I want.
I can ransom the hammer, said Loki. I can bring you gold and amber. I can bring you treasures beyond counting.
Don't want them, said the ogre. I want to marry Freya. Bring her here in 8 days from now. I'll return the hammer of the gods as a bride gift on Freya's wedding night.
Who are you? Asked Loki. The ogre grinned and showed his crooked teeth.
Why, Loki, son of Loive, I am Thrym, lord of the ogres.
I have no doubt that we can come to an arrangement, great Thrym, said Loki. He drew Freya's feather cloak around him, then stretched his arms and took to the skies.
Beneath Loki, the world seemed very small. He looked down at the trees and the mountains, tiny as children's playthings, and the problems of the gods seemed a small thing also. Thor was waiting for him in the court of the gods, and before Loki had even landed, he found himself seized by Thor's huge hands.
Well, you know something. I can see it in your face. Tell me whatever you know, and tell it now. I don't trust you, Loki, and I want to know what you know right this moment before you've had a chance to plot and to plan.
Loki, who plotted and planned as easily as other folk breathed in and out, smiled at Thor's anger and innocence.
Your hammer has been stolen by Thrym, lord of all the ogres, he said. I have persuaded him to return it to you, but he demands a price.
Fair enough, said Thor. What's the price?
Freya's hand in marriage.
He just wants her hand? Asked Thor, hopefully.
She had two hands, after all, and might be persuaded to give up one of them without too much of an argument. Tyr had, after all.
All of her, said Loki. He wants to marry her.
Oh, said Thor. She won't like that.
Well, you can tell her the news. You're better at persuading people to do things than I am when I'm not holding my hammer. They went together to Freya's court once more. Here's your feathered cloak, said Loki. Thank you, said Freya. Did you find out who stole Thor's hammer?
Thrym, lord of the ogres.
I've heard of him. A nasty piece of work.
What does he want for it?
You, said Loki. He wants to marry you.
Freya nodded.
Thor was pleased that she seemed to have accepted the idea so easily.
Put on your bridal crown, Freya, and pack your things, he said. You and Loki are going to the land of the giants. We need to get you married off to Thrym before he changes his mind. I want my hammer back.
Freya did not say anything.
Thor noticed that the ground was shaking, as were the walls. Freya's cats mewed and hissed, and they fled beneath a chest of furs and would not come out. Freya's hands were squeezed into tight fists. The necklace of the Brisings tumbled from her neck to the floor. She did not appear to notice. She was staring at Thor and Loki as if they were the lowest, most unpleasant vermin she had ever seen. Thor was almost relieved when Freya began to speak.
What kind of person do you think I am? She asked, very quietly. Do you think I'm that foolish, that disposable, that I'm someone who would actually marry an ogre just to get you out of trouble? If you two think that I am going to the land of the giants, that I'll put on a bridal crown and veil and submit to the touch and the lust of that ogre, that I'd marry him. Well.
She stopped talking. The walls shuddered once again, and Thor feared the entire building would fall upon them.
Get out, said Freya. What kind of woman do you think I am?
But my hammer, said Thor.
Shut up, Thor, said Loki.
Thor shut up. They left.
She's very beautiful when she's angry, said Thor. You can see why that ogre wants to marry her.
Shut up, Thor, said Loki again.
They called a gathering of all the gods in the great hall. Every god and goddess was there except Freya, who declined to leave her house. All day they talked, debated, and argued. There was no question that they needed to get Mjolnir back. But how? Each god and goddess made a suggestion, and each suggestion was shot down by Loki. In the end, only one god had not spoken. Heimdall, the far-seeing, who watches over the world. Not one thing happens that Heimdall does not see, and sometimes he sees events that have yet to occur in the world.
Well, said Loki, what about you, Heimdall? Do you have any suggestions?
I do, said Heimdall,
but you won't like it.
Thor banged his fist down upon the table.
It does not matter whether or not we like it, he said. We are gods. There is nothing that any of us gathered here would not do to get back Mjolnir, the hammer of the gods. Tell us your idea, and if it is a good idea, we will like it.
You won't like it, said Heimdall.
We will like it, said Thor.
Well, said Heimdall, I think we should dress Thor as a bride, have him put on the necklace of the Brisings, have him wear a bridal crown, stuff his dress so he looks like a woman, veil his face. We'll have him wear keys that jingle, as women do, drape him with jewels.
I don't like it, said Thor. People will think, well, for a start, they'll think I dress up in women's clothes. Absolutely out of the question. I don't like it. I am definitely not going to be wearing a bridal veil. None of us like this idea, do we? Terrible, terrible idea. I've got a beard. I can't shave off my beard.
Shut up, Thor, said Loki, son of Loive. It's an excellent idea. If you don't want the giants to invade Asgard, you will put on a wedding veil, which will hide your face and your beard. Odin, the All-Highest, said,
It is indeed an excellent idea. Well done, Heimdall. We need the hammer back, and this is the best way. Goddesses, prepare Thor for his wedding night.
The goddesses brought him things to wear. Frigg and Futla, Sif, Idun, and the rest. Even Skathi, Freya's stepmother, came and helped to prepare him. They dressed him in the finest clothes, the kind a high-born goddess would wear to her wedding. Frigg went to see Freya and came back with the necklace of the Brisings, and she hung it about Thor's neck. Sif, Thor's wife, hung her keys at Thor's side. Ithun brought all her jewels, which she draped about Thor so that he glittered and gleamed in the candlelight. And she brought 100 rings of red gold and white gold to go on Thor's fingers. They covered his face with a veil, so that only his eyes could be seen. And Vaua, the goddess of marriage, placed a shining headdress upon Thor's head, a bridal crown high and wide and beautiful.
I'm not sure about the eyes, Vaua said. They don't look very feminine.
I should hope not, muttered Thor.
Vaua looked at Thor.
If I pull down the headdress, it will hide them, but he still has to be able to see.
Do your best, said Loki. And then he said, I'll be your maidservant and go with you to the land of the giants. Loki shifted his shape, and now he was, in voice and in appearance, a beautiful young serving woman.
There. How do I look?
Thor muttered something under his breath, but it might have been a good thing that nobody could hear it. Loki and Thor clambered into Thor's chariot, and the goats who pulled it, Snarler and Grinder, leapt into the skies, eager to be off. Mountains broke in half as they passed, and the earth burst into flame beneath them.
I have a bad feeling about this, said Thor.
Don't speak, said Loki in the form of a maiden. Let me do all the talking. Can you remember that? If you speak, you may ruin everything.
Thor grunted. They landed in the courtyard. Giant-sized jet-black oxen stood impassively. Each beast was larger than a house. The tips of their horns were capped with gold, and the courtyard stank with the sharp smell of their dung. A booming voice could be heard from inside the huge high hall.
Move it, you fools! Spread clean straw on the benches! What do you think you're doing? Well, pick it up or cover it with straw! Don't just leave it there to rot. This is Freya, the most beautiful creature in existence. Njord's daughter who comes to us. She won't want to see something like that.
There was a path made of fresh straw through the courtyard, and after leaving their chariot, the disguised Thor and the serving maiden who was Loki walked across the straw, lifting their skirts so they did not drag in the muck. A giant woman was waiting for them. She introduced herself as Thrym's sister, and she reached down and pinched Loki's pretty cheek between her fingertips, and she prodded Thor with one sharp fingernail.
So this is the most beautiful woman in the world? Doesn't look much to me. And when she picked up her skirts, it seemed to me that her ankles were as thick as small tree trunks.
A trick of the light. She is the most beautiful of all the gods, said the maiden who was Loki smoothly. When her veil comes off, I promise you will be struck down by her beauty. Now where is her groom? Where is the wedding feast? She is so eager for this. I have barely been able to restrain her.
The sun was setting as they were led into the great hall for the wedding feast.
What if he wants me to sit next to him?
Whispered Thor to Loki.
You have to sit next to him. That's where the bride sits.
But he might try and put his hand on my leg, Thor whispered urgently.
I'll sit between you, said Loki. I'll tell him it's our custom.
Thrym sat at the head of the table, and Loki sat next to him, with Thor at the next seat on the bench.
Thrym clapped his hands, and giant serving men came in. They carried 5 whole roast oxen, enough to feed the giants. They brought in 20 whole baked salmon, each fish the size of a 10-year-old boy. Also, they carried in dozens of trays of little pastries and fancies intended for the women.
They were followed by 5 more serving men, each one carrying a whole cask of mead. A barrel huge enough that each giant struggled beneath the weight of it.
This meal is for the beautiful Freya, said Thrym,
and he might have said something else, but Thor had already started to eat and to drink, and it would have been rude for Thrym to have talked while the bride-to-be was eating.
A tray of pastries for the womenfolk was placed in front of Loki and Thor. Loki carefully picked out the smallest pastry. Thor, just as carefully, swept the rest of the pastries up, and they vanished to the sound of munching under the veil. The other women, who had been looking at the pastries hungrily, glared, disappointed, at the beautiful Freya. But the beautiful Freya had not even begun to eat. Thor ate a whole ox all by himself. He ate 7 entire salmon, leaving nothing but the bones. Each time a tray of pastries was brought to him, he devoured all the fancies and pastries on it, leaving all the other women hungry. Sometimes Loki would kick him under the table, but Thor ignored every kick and just kept eating. Thrym tapped Loki on the shoulder.
Excuse me, he said, but the lovely Freya has just polished off her third cask of mead.
I'm sure she has, said the maiden who was Loki.
Amazing. I've never seen any woman eat so ravenously, never seen any woman eat so much or drink so much mead.
There is, said Loki, an obvious explanation.
He took a deep breath and watched Thor inhale another whole salmon and pull a salmon skeleton out from under his veil. It was like watching a magic trick. He wondered what the obvious explanation was.
That makes 8 salmon she's eaten, said Thrym.
8 days and 8 nights, said Loki suddenly. She hasn't eaten for 8 days and 8 nights. She was so keen to come to the land of the giants and make love to her new husband. Now she is in your presence. She is finally eating again.
The maiden turned to Thor.
It's so good to see you eating again, my dear, she said.
Thor glared at Loki from beneath the veil.
I should kiss her, said Thrym.
I wouldn't advise it, not yet,
said Loki, but Thrym had already leaned over and was making kissing noises. With one huge hand he reached for Thor's veil. The maiden who was Loki put out her arm to stop him, but it was too late. Thrym had already stopped making kissing noises and had sprung back, shaken. Thrym tapped the maiden who was Loki on the shoulder.
Can I talk with you? He said.
Of course.
They got up and walked across the hall.
Why are Freya's eyes so terrifying? Asked Thrym. It seemed as if there was a fire burning inside them. Those weren't the eyes of a beautiful woman.
Of course not, said the maiden who was Loki smoothly. You wouldn't expect them to be. She hasn't slept for 8 days and 8 nights, mighty Thrym. She was so consumed by love for you that she dared not sleep. She was so mad to taste your love. She's burning up inside for you. That's what you're seeing in those eyes. Burning passion.
Oh, said Thrym. I see.
He smiled and licked his lips with a tongue bigger than a human pillow.
Well then.
They walked back to the table. Thrym's sister had sat down in Loki's seat beside Thor and was tapping her fingernails on Thor's hand. If you know what's good for you, you'll give me your rings, she was saying. All your pretty golden rings. You'll be a stranger in this castle. You'll need someone looking out for you, otherwise things are going to get pretty nasty so far from home. You've got so many rings. Give me some as a bridal gift, so pretty they are, all red and gold.
Isn't it time for the wedding? Asked Loki.
It is, said Thrym.
He boomed at the top of his voice.
Bring in the hammer to sanctify the bride. I want to see Mjolnir placed on the beautiful Freya's lap. Let Vaur, the goddess of pledges between men and women, bless and consecrate our love.
It took 4 giants to carry Thor's hammer. They brought it in from deep inside the hall. It glinted dully in the firelight. With difficulty, they placed it on Thor's lap.
Now, said Thrym. Now let me hear your beautiful voice, my love, my dove, my sweetness. Tell me that you love me. Tell me that you will be my bride. Tell me that you pledge yourself to me as women have pledged themselves to men and men to women since the beginning of time. What do you say?
Thor held the haft of his hammer with a hand that was covered with golden rings. He squeezed it reassuringly. It felt familiar and comfortable in his hand. He started laughing then, a deep, booming laugh.
What I say, said Thor, in a voice like thunder, is that you should not have taken my hammer.
He hit Thrym with his hammer. Only once, but once was all it took.
The ogre fell to the straw-covered floor and did not rise again. All the giants and ogres fell beneath Thor's hammer, the guests at the wedding that was never to be. Even Thrym's sister, who received a bridal gift she had not been expecting. And when the hall was silent, Thor called, "Loki!"
Loki climbed out from under the table, in his original shape, and surveyed the carnage.
"Well," he said, "you appear to have dealt with the problem."
Thor was already taking off his women's skirts with relief. He stood there, wearing nothing but a shirt, in a room filled with dead giants.
"There! That wasn't as bad as I had feared," he said cheerfully. "I've got my hammer back, and I had a good dinner. Let's go home."
The Mead of Poets. Do you wonder where poetry comes from? Where we get the songs we sing and the tales we tell? Do you ever ask yourself how it is that some people can dream great, wise, beautiful dreams and pass those dreams on as poetry to the world, to be sung and retold as long as the sun rises and sets, as long as the moon will wax and wane? Have you ever wondered why some people make beautiful songs and poems and tales, and some of us do not? It is a long story, and it does no credit to anyone. There is murder in it, and trickery, lies and foolishness, seduction and pursuit. Listen. It began not long after the dawn of time, in a war between the gods. The Aesir fought the Vanir. The Aesir were warlike gods of battle and conquest. The Vanir were softer, brother and sister gods and goddesses who made the soils fertile and the plants grow, but nonetheless powerful for that. The gods of the Vanir and the Aesir were too well matched. Neither side could win the war. And more than that, as they fought, they realized that each side needed the other. That there is no joy in a brave battle unless you have fine fields and farms to feed you in the feasting that follows. They came together to negotiate a peace, and once the negotiations were concluded, they marked their truce by each of them, Aesir and Vanir alike, one by one, spitting into a vat. As their spit mingled, so was their agreement made binding. Then they had a feast. Food was eaten, mead was drunk, and they caroused and joked and talked and boasted and laughed as the fires became glowing coals until the sun crept up above the horizon. Then, as the Aesir and the Vanir roused themselves to leave, to wrap themselves in furs and cloth, and step out into the crisp snow and the morning mist, Odin said, "It would be a shame to leave our mingled spittle behind us." Frey and Freya, brother and sister, were leaders of the Vanir, who would stay with the Aesir in Asgard from now on, under the terms of the truce. They nodded. "We could make something from it," said Frey. "We should make a man," said Freya, and she reached into the vat. The spittle transformed and took shape as her fingers moved, and in moments it had taken on the appearance of a man and stood naked before them. "You are Kvasir," said Odin. "Do you know who I am?"
"You are Odin All-Highest," said Kvasir. "You are Grimnir and Third. You have other names, too many to list in this place, but I know them all, and I know the poems and the chants and the kennings that go with them." Kvasir, made of the joining of the Aesir and the Vanir, was the wisest of the gods. He combined head and heart. The gods jostled each other to be the next to ask him questions, and his answers to them were always wise. He observed keenly, and he interpreted what he saw correctly. Soon enough, Kvasir turned to the gods and said, "I'm going to travel now. I'm going to see the Nine Worlds, see Midgard. There are questions to be answered that I have not yet been asked." "But you will come back to us?" they asked.
"I will come back," said Kvasir. "There is the mystery of the net, after all, which one day will need to be untangled."
"The what?" asked Thor.
But Kvasir merely smiled, and he left the gods puzzling over his words, and he put on a traveling cloak, and he left Asgard and walked the Rainbow Bridge. Kvasir went from town to town, from village to village. He met people of all kinds, and he treated them well and answered their questions, and there was not a place but was the better for Kvasir's stopping there. In those days, there were two dark elves who lived in a fortress by the sea. They did magic there, and feats of alchemy. Like all dwarfs, they built things. Wonderful, remarkable things in their workshop and their forge. But there were things they had not yet made, and making those things obsessed them. They were brothers, and were called Fiala and Galla. When they heard that Kvasir was visiting a town nearby, they set out to meet him. Fiala and Galla found Kvasir in the great hall, answering questions for the townsfolk, amazing all who listened. He told the people how to purify water, and how to make cloth from nettles. He told one woman exactly who had stolen her knife and why. Once he was done talking and the townsfolk had fed him, the dwarfs approached. "We have a question to ask you that you have never been asked before," they said, "but it must be asked in private. Will you come with us?"
"I will come," said Kvasir.
They walked to the fortress. The seagulls screamed, and the brooding grey clouds were the same shade as the grey of the waves. The dwarfs led Kvasir to their workshop, deep within the walls of their fortress.
"What are those?"
asked Kvasir.
"They are vats. They are called Son and Bothan."
"I see.
And what is that over there?"
"How can you be so wise when you do not know these things?
It is a kettle. We call it Othrerir, ecstasy giver.
And I see over here you have buckets of honey you have gathered. It is uncapped and liquid."
"Indeed we do," said Fiala.
Galla looked scornful.
"If you were as wise as they say you are, you would know what our question to you would be before we asked it. And you would know what these things are for."
Kvasir nodded in a resigned way.
"It seems to me," he said, "that if you were both intelligent and evil, you might have decided to kill your visitor and let his blood flow into the vats, Son and Bothan, and then you would heat his blood gently in your kettle, Othrerir, and after that you would blend uncapped honey into the mixture and let it ferment until it became mead, the finest mead, a drink that will intoxicate anyone who drinks it, but also give anyone who tastes it the gift of poetry and the gift of scholarship." "We are intelligent," admitted Galar, "and perhaps there are those who might think us evil."
And with that he slashed Kvasir's throat, and they hung Kvasir by his feet above the vats until the last drop of his blood was drained. They warmed the blood and the honey in the kettle called Othrerir, and did other things to it of their own devising. They put berries into it and stirred it with a stick. It bubbled, and then it ceased bubbling, and both of them sipped it and laughed, and each of the brothers found the verse and the poetry inside himself that he had never let out. The gods came the next morning.
"Kvasir," they said, "he was last seen with you." "Yes," said the dwarfs. "He came back with us, but when he realized that we are only dwarfs, and foolish and lacking in wisdom, he choked on his own knowledge. If only we had been able to ask him questions."
"He died, you say?"
"Yes," said Fiala and Galla, and they gave the gods Kvasir's bloodless body to take back to Asgard for a god's funeral, and perhaps, because gods are not as others and death is not always permanent for them, for a god's eventual return. Thus it was that the dwarfs had the mead of wisdom and poetry, and any person who wished to taste it needed to beg it from the dwarfs. But Galla and Fiala gave the mead only to those they liked, and they liked nobody but themselves. Still, there were those to whom they had obligations, the giant Gitling, for example, and his wife. The dwarfs invited them to come and visit their fortress, and one winter's day they came. "Let us go rowing in our boat," the dwarfs told Gitling. The giant's weight made the boat ride low in the water, and the dwarfs rowed the boat onto the rocks just under the surface. Always before, their boat had floated serenely above the rocks. Not this time. The boat crashed onto the rocks and overturned, throwing the giant into the sea. "Swim back to the boat," the brothers called to Gitling.
"I cannot swim," he said, and that was the last thing he said, for a wave filled his open mouth with salt water, and his head hit the rocks, and in a moment he was lost to view. Fjalla and Gulla righted their boat and went home. Gitling's wife was waiting for them.
"Where is my husband?" she asked.
"Him," said Gulla. "Oh, he's dead."
"Drowned," added Fjalla helpfully. At this, the giant's wife wailed and sobbed as if each cry were being ripped from her soul. She called to her dead husband and swore she would love him always, and she cried and moaned and wept.
"Hush," said Gulla. "Your weeping and wailing hurts my ears. It's very loud. I expect that's because you're a giant."
But the giant's wife simply wept the louder.
"Here," said Fjalla, "would it help if we showed you the place where your husband died?"
She sniffed and nodded and cried and wailed and keened for her husband, who would never come back to her.
"Stand just over there and we will point it out to you," said Fjalla, showing her exactly where she should stand, that she should go through the great door and stand beneath the wall of the fortress. And he nodded to his brother, who scurried off up the steps to the wall above.
As Gitling's wife walked through the door, Gulla dropped a huge stone on her head, and she fell, her skull half crushed.
"Good job," said Fjalla. "I was getting very tired of those dreadful noises."
They pushed the woman's lifeless body off the rocks and into the sea. The fingers of the grey waves dragged her body away from them, and Gitling's wife and Gitling were reunited in death. The dwarfs shrugged and believed themselves to be extremely clever in their fortress by the sea. They drank the mead of poetry each night and declaimed great and beautiful verses to each other, made mighty sagas about the death of Gitling and Gitling's wife, which they declaimed from the rooftop of their fortress, and eventually each night they slept insensible and woke where they had sat down or fallen the night before. One day they woke as usual, but they did not wake in their fortress. They woke on the floor of their boat, and a giant whom they did not recognize was rowing it into the waves. The sky was dark with storm clouds and the sea was black. The waves were high and rough, and the salt water splashed over the side of the dwarf's boat, soaking them.
"Who are you?"
asked the dwarfs.
"I am Suttung," said the giant. "I heard you were bragging to the wind and the waves and the world about having killed my father and mother."
"Ah," said Gulla. "Does that explain why you have tied us up?"
"It does," said Suttung. "Perhaps you are taking us to a glorious place," said Fjalla hopefully, "where you will untie us, and there we will feast and drink and laugh and become the best of friends."
"I do not believe so," said Suttung.
It was low tide. There were rocks jutting out above the water. They were the same rocks upon which, at high tide, the dwarf's boat had overturned, on which Gitling had drowned. Suttung picked up each of the dwarfs, took him from the bottom of the boat, and placed him on the rocks.
"These rocks will be covered by the sea at high tide," said Fjalla. "Our hands are tied behind our backs. We cannot swim. If you leave us here, we will undoubtedly drown."
"That is certainly the intention," said Suttung.
He smiled then for the first time.
"And as you drown, I shall sit in this, your boat, and I shall watch the sea take you both. Then I shall return home to Jotunheim, and I will tell my brother Baugi,
and my daughter, Gunnloth, how you died, and we will be satisfied that my mother and my father were appropriately avenged." The sea began to rise. It covered the dwarf's feet, and then it came up to their navels. Soon enough, the dwarf's beards were floating in the foam, and there was panic in their eyes.
"Mercy!" they called.
"Like the mercy you gave my mother and my father.
We will compensate you for their deaths. We will make it up to you. We will pay you."
"I do not believe that you dwarfs possess anything that could compensate me for my parents' deaths. I'm a wealthy giant. I have many servants in my mountain fastness and all the riches I could dream of. Gold I have, and precious stones, and iron enough to make 1,000 swords. I am the master of mighty magics. What could you give me that I do not already have?" asked Suttung.
The dwarfs said nothing at all. The waves continued to rise.
"We have mead, the mead of poetry," sputtered Gulla
as the water brushed his lips.
"Made of Kvasir's blood, wisest of all the gods," shouted Fiala. "Two vats and a kettle all filled with it. No one has it but us, no one in the whole world."
Suttung scratched his head.
"I must think about this. I must ponder. I must reflect."
"Do not stop and think. If you think, we will drown,"
shouted Fiala over the roar of the waves. The tide rose. Waves were splashing over the dwarfs' heads, and they were gulping air, and their eyes were round with fear when Suttung the giant reached out and plucked first Fiala and then Gulla from the waves.
"The mead of poetry will be adequate compensation. It is a fair price if you throw in a few other things, and I'm sure you dwarfs have a few other things. I shall spare your lives."
He tossed them, still bound and soaking, into the bottom of the boat, where they wriggled uncomfortably, like a couple of bearded lobsters, and he rowed back to shore. Suttung took the mead the dwarves had made from Kvasir's blood. He took other things from them as well, and he left that place, and he left those dwarfs who were, all things considered, happy enough to have gotten away with their lives. Fiala and Gulla told people who passed their fortress the story of how ill-used they had been by Suttung. They told it in the market when next they went to trade. They told it when ravens were near. In Asgard, at his high seat, Odin sat, and his ravens, Hugin and Munin, whispered to him of the things they had seen and heard as they had wandered the world. Odin's one eye flashed when he heard the tale of Suttung's mead. The people who heard the story called the mead of poetry the ship of the dwarfs, since it had floated Fiala and Gulla off the rocks and taken them safely home. They called it Suttung's mead. They called it the liquid of Othrere, or Bothan, or Son. Odin listened to his raven's words. He called for his cloak and his hat. He sent for the gods and told them to prepare 3 enormous wooden vats, the largest vats that they could build, and to have them waiting by the gates of Asgard. He told the gods he would be leaving them to walk the world, and might be some time.
"I will take 2 things with me," said Odin. "I need a whetstone to sharpen a blade with, the finest we have here, and I wish to have the auger, the drill, called Rati."
Rati means drill, and Rati was the finest drill the gods possessed. It could drill deeply and drill through the hardest rock. Odin tossed the whetstone into the air and caught it again and put it into his pouch beside the auger. Then he walked away.
"I wonder what he's going to do," said Thor.
"Kvasir would have known," said Frigg. "He knew everything."
"Kvasir is dead," said Loki. "As for me, I do not care where the Allfather is going, or why.
I am off to help build the wooden vats that the Allfather requested," said Thor.
Suttung
had given the precious mead to his daughter, Gunnloth, to watch over inside the mountain called Hnitbjörg, in the heart of giant country. Odin did not go to the mountain. Instead, he went directly to the farmland owned by Suttung's brother, Baugi. It was spring, and the fields were high with grasses to be cut for hay. Baugi had 9 slaves, giants like himself, and they were cutting the grass for hay with huge scythes, each scythe the size of a small tree. Odin watched them. When they stopped work, when the sun was at its highest to eat their provisions, Odin sauntered over to them and said, "I have been watching you all work. Tell me, why does your master let you cut grass with such blunt scythes?"
"The blades are not blunt," said one of the workers.
"Why would you say that?" asked another. "Our blades are the sharpest."
"Let me show you what a well-sharpened blade can do," said Odin.
He took the whetstone from his pouch and drew it along first one scythe blade, then another, until each blade glimmered in the sun. The giants stood around him awkwardly, watching him as he worked.
"Now," said Odin, "try them out."
The giant slaves swept their scythes through the meadow grass and gasped and exclaimed with pleasure. The blades were so sharp they made cutting the grass effortless. The blades swept through the thickest stalks and met with no resistance.
"This is wonderful," they told Odin. "Can we buy your whetstone?"
"Buy it?" said the Allfather.
"Absolutely not. Let us do something more fair and more fun. All of you, come here, stand in a group, each man holding his scythe tightly. Stand closer."
"We can stand no closer," said one of the giant slaves, "for the scythes are very sharp."
"You are wise," said Odin.
He held up the whetstone.
"I tell you this, the one of you who catches it, he alone shall have it."
And so saying, he tossed the whetstone into the air.
9 giants jumped at the whetstone as it descended, each reaching with his free hand, paying no attention to the scythe he held, each scythe with a blade sharpened by the Allfather at his whetstone whetted to a perfect sharpness.
They jumped and they reached, and the blades glinted in the sun. There was a spray and a spurt of crimson in the sunlight, and the bodies of the slaves crumpled and twitched and one by one fell to the freshly cut grass. Odin stepped over the bodies of the giants, retrieved the whetstone of the gods, and placed it back in his pouch. Each of the 9 slaves had died, with his throat cut by his fellow's blade. Odin walked to the hall of Baugi, Suttung's brother, and asked for lodging for the night.
"I am called Búlverka," said Odin.
"Búlverka," said Baugi.
"A dismal name. It means worker of terrible things."
"Only to my enemies," said the person who called himself Búlverka. "My friends appreciate the things I do. I can do the work of 9 men, and I will work tirelessly and without complaint."
"Lodging for the night is yours," said Baugi, sighing. "But you have come to me on a dark day. Yesterday I was a rich man, with many fields and with 9 slaves to plant and to harvest, to labor and to build. Tonight I still own my fields and my animals, but all my servants are dead. They slew each other. I do not know why."
"A dark day indeed," said the Búlverka, who was Odin. "Can you not get other workmen?"
"Nah, not this year," sighed Baugi. "It is already spring. The good workers are already working for my brother Suttung, and few enough people come here in the way of things. You are the first traveller who's asked me for lodging and hospitality in many a year. And lucky you are that I did, for I can do the work of 9 men."
"You are not a giant," said Baugi.
"You are a little shrimp of a thing,
How could you do the work of one of my servants, let alone nine of them?
If I cannot do the work of your nine men, said Bolverka, then you need not pay me.
But if I do...
Yes.
Even in distant parts, we have heard tales about your brother Suttung's extraordinary mead. They say it bestows the gift of poetry on anyone who drinks it.
This is true.
Suttung was never a poet when we were young. I was the poet in the family. But since he has returned with the dwarf's mead, he has become a poet and a dreamer. If I work for you, and plant and build and harvest for you and do the work of your dead servants, I would like to taste your brother Suttung's mead.
But...
Baugi's forehead creased.
But that is not mine to give. It is Suttung's.
Ah, a pity, said Bulverka. Then I wish you luck in getting the harvest in this year.
Wait! It is not mine, true.
But if you can do what you say, I will go with you to see my brother Suttung, and I will do all I can to help you taste his mead.
Then, said Bulverka, we have a deal.
Never was there a harder worker than Bulverka. He worked the land harder than 20 men, let alone 9. Single-handed, he looked after the animals. Single-handed, he harvested the crops. He worked the land, and the land repaid him 1,000-fold.
Bulverka,
said Baugi, as the first mists of winter rolled down the mountain, you are misnamed, for you have worked nothing but good.
Have I done the work of 9 men?
You have, and 9 again.
Then will you help me to get a taste of Suttung's mead?
I shall.
The next morning, they rose early, and walked and walked and walked, and by evening they had left Baugi's land and reached Suttung's, on the edge of the mountains. By nightfall, they reached Suttung's huge hall.
Greetings, brother Suttung, said Baugi. This is Bulverka, my servant for the summer, and my friend.
And he told Suttung of his agreement with Bulverka.
So you see, he concluded, I must ask you to give him a taste of the mead of poetry.
Suttung's eyes were like chips of ice.
No,
he said flatly.
No, said Baugi. No, I will not give away a single drop of that mead. Not one drop. I have it safe in its vats, in Borthen, and Sohn, and the kettle Othrarir. Those vats are deep inside the mountain of Hnipjörg, which opens only to my command. My daughter, Gunloth, guards it. This servant of yours cannot taste it. You cannot taste it.
But, said Baugi, it was blood compensation for our parents' deaths. Don't I deserve the smallest measure of it to show Bulverka here that I am an honorable giant?
No, said Suttung, you don't.
They left his hall. Baugi was disconsolate. He walked with his shoulders hunched high and his mouth drooping down. Every few paces, Baugi would apologize to Bulverka.
I did not think my brother would be so unreasonable, he would say.
He is indeed unreasonable, said Bulverka, who was Odin in disguise.
But you and I could play a little trick or two on him so that he would not be so high and mighty in future, so that next time he will listen to his brother.
We could do that,
said the giant Baugi. And he stood straighter, and the corners of his mouth tightened into something that almost resembled a smile.
What are we going to do?
First, said Bulverka, we will climb Hnipjörg, the beating mountain. They climbed Hnipjörg together, the giant going first, and Bulverka, doll-sized in comparison, never falling behind. They clambered up the paths that the mountain sheep and goats made, and then they scrambled up rocks until they were high in the mountain. The first snows of winter had fallen on the ice that had not melted from the winter before.
They heard the wind as it whistled about the mountain. They heard the cries of birds far below them, and there was something else they could hear. It was a noise like a human voice. It seemed to be coming from the rocks of the mountain, but it was always